From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. When Stephen Morgan showed up in 1969, guitar in hand, to be a camp counselor for what is now the ARC Baltimore, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities often lived in institutions, seldom on their own. Children with mental disabilities were not entitled to free, appropriate public education. Morgan has been head of the ARC Baltimore for three decades and has witnessed a big change.
The opportunities that folks with that situation have and the choices that they can avail themselves of to live in the communities, to have jobs in the community, to be regular members of society.
Ahead of Morgan's retirement next month, we talk about what kinds of jobs make sense for people with disabilities, what prompts businesses to hire them, and what police need to understand about them. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. More than 7,000 people with intellectual or developmental disabilities turn to the ARC Baltimore for support, to find a job that fits them, or a place to live, or the supports that keep them independent or give their caregivers a break. The kinds of support have changed dramatically since the ARC started in 1949 as the Maryland Society for Mentally Retarded Children. Observing the changes and leading many of them has been Stephen Morgan, who started as a camp counselor in 1969, was named executive director in 1985, and will retire next month. Steve Morgan is with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
What's the biggest change you've seen in three decades heading the ARC?
Well, it's hard to identify a singular change. I think it's the fact that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, as we refer to the folks that we support now. Back in the day, the term most often used was mental retardation, but that term grew increasingly out of favor. And for probably 10 or 15 years now, we've talked about people with intellectual disabilities instead of using the term mental retardation. But it's really the same condition, the same situation. But what has changed and grown over the years is the opportunities that folks with that situation have and the choices that they can avail themselves of to live in the communities, to have jobs in the community, to be regular members of society, and to be included in the mainstream of their neighborhoods and communities and workplaces.
Yeah, I saw one of the videos that the ARC Baltimore has on YouTube where someone who worked with you was quoted as saying, what's changed is now the expectation is that someone will be employed. It's not the exception anymore.
Right.
Tell me what went into that. What was the employment situation, for example, when you took over as deputy executive director in 1979?
Well, during that time period and previously, there were relatively few, practically no people that were employed in regular competitive jobs and businesses in the community. Most often people were either in sheltered workshop facilities, which were segregated environments where they would do piece rate work, often provided by local companies, assembly, packaging, and the like. At the time, it was meaningful and important to them, but the wages they earned weren't that great, and it really didn't give the opportunities for them to be part of the mainstream in the community. And so we worked hard to find opportunities outside of those centers, either on work crews, supervised work crews, or individual placements with host businesses whenever we could. I guess the thinking that went into it really was our own realization that we had, in some senses, pigeonholed people and not expected them to achieve as much as they were capable of. And when we realized that folks really could do more, they could be out in the community, they could earn better wages, then we made it that our goal and our mission, really, to get people out of those sheltered and segregated facilities.
Take me into, if you remember, when that realization crystallized for people who worked at the ARC.
Well, it wasn't a single point in time, but I would say through the 70s and probably into the 80s. And one of the reasons it took a while for that realization about the capacity of people to work in the community, to have jobs, et cetera. It took a while to get there because previously there had been a lot more focus on getting people out of institutions or avoiding people having to go into institutions in order to have a place to live. If we go way back in the history of how people with mental retardation, now intellectual disabilities, were treated or what options were available, there were few, next to none. And so families, as parents got older, they had little to no choice other than to place their adult child in a state-run institution so that they would have a place to live when the parents passed on. And so as the realization grew in that realm that people didn't need to live in an isolated, segregated facility, but could live in small group homes in the community. That was kind of the first order of business in the 60s and 70s to begin the process of, as I said, both getting people out of state-run institutions, if that's where they had found themselves, or preferably to avoid them having to go into an institution at all. And so there was less attention to the idea of having a job and more just getting people settled into a home in the community. So a little later on, though, then is when that realization about greater capacity than just being in a workshop or a day center, capacity to work in the community. And so we provided the supports and the training people needed to get regular jobs in the community.
That 2012 video I mentioned, the ARC was describing its efforts to place people with disabilities at jobs in private businesses. One young man named Brad talked about working in landscaping for St. John's Properties.
My name is Brad, and I work for Police and Crew at St. John's Properties. Working in the community is a good responsibility.
The people from ARC are absolutely engaged. They like doing it. They're proud of what they do, and they go out of their way to make sure it's done right. That's the difference we see.
My job makes me feel good, proud of myself.
So that young man worked for St. John's Properties. How did you go about finding those placements? How do you go about finding those placements?
The primary way that we find jobs or help other people find jobs is by word of mouth. So one person works successfully for a company, and that company, that employer, talks to a colleague who runs either a similar type business or an altogether different type of business, basically saying, you know, I've had great success with a person with a disability referred by the ARC. You ought to give it a try. And so that opens another door for us to begin the conversation about employing a person with disability, with an intellectual disability. And it really is, it's about building a relationship, really initially, of trust with the employer that they're going to get a reliable producing worker. It's not charity. It's all about somebody that's going to help them further their mission to run a responsible business and get a product or a service. And so that's really the key. I mean, we do a little bit of, you know, advertising and promotion and public relations and that kind of thing. But the word of mouth is probably where we are most successful in opening doors to new employment opportunities.
What tend to be the concerns of employers?
Well, I think, although this I think is not as much as it used to be, I think there used to be concerns about safety on the job. Is a person with a disability going to have more accidents if it's like an industrial setting, for example? Are they going to put the company at risk of having that person, you know, get injured or whatever, particularly if they use equipment or machinery or anything like that? Are they going to be reliable? Are they going to miss a lot of days and all? And it really has been because enough employers now have had the experience to dispel those myths. So they realize that, in fact, they have better safety records and better attendance records than your average employee.
That's Stephen Morgan here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Morgan will retire next month after more than three decades heading the ARC Baltimore. We're talking about some of the changes in how society connects with people who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. Let's talk about wages. The big fight in recent years over whether people with disabilities should be paid a lower minimum wage. As I recall, the ARC Baltimore was apprehensive about getting rid of the subminimum wage?
Well, there was some apprehension because the whole idea of subminimum wage was to be a bridge or an opportunity to grow into better paying jobs. And we were concerned that if it was suddenly eliminated, that people might not have that bridge to full employment, to full paying minimum wage employment.
In other words, that if employers needed to pay a full minimum wage, they would not hire people with disabilities?
Yes, that was the concern.
How much lower was the subminimum wage?
Well, it varied. It was based on a productivity time study of each individual. So it could be as low as half of minimum wage. I would say on average, when we were paying subminimum wages, and I have to add, of course, that we've stopped doing that altogether now. We have no subminimum wage employees any longer. But back when we did, most of the folks were earning 75 or 80% of the minimum wage. And again, it was based on a productivity study that showed that basically they, when measured, could perform whatever the task was at about 80% of the rate of a non-disabled worker. And so that was the basis for paying the subminimum wage. But now that's all eliminated. And again, we were fine because although it was phased in gradually, we just went ahead. We would have had 4 years to phase it out and instead phased it out in a year and a half. So that's all history now.
And has it had any of the ill effects you worried about in terms of reducing the number of jobs available to people with disabilities?
We haven't seen it happen with individuals in private working for private sector businesses. Now, I still have a little bit of concern or caution because the state's minimum wage is continuing to rise. I think it just went to 870, or is going to 875 or 9.25 this July 1st, and then we'll go up to 1010 a year or two after that. I'm not terribly worried. I guess it could have an impact if some of the private sector employers aren't willing to step up to that wage. But I don't think that's going to be a huge concern.
What are the kinds of jobs that make sense for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
Well, it's really quite varied. I should mention that we sponsor or operate a number of our own service crews, people doing landscaping. The gentleman just heard worked for
St. John's Properties,
was on a crew where actually St. John Properties contracts with the ARC, and we in turn pay the wages. Again, it's still minimum wage. So that's an area, landscaping, custodial, janitorial work in commercial buildings, office buildings, et cetera. And then a similar type of work to landscaping called policing, which is actually a military term. It's really cleaning up grounds. It's not so much grounds maintenance as it is grounds cleanup. In those three areas, we've had great success employing actually a little over 200 people on crews that are really, they're our crews doing work for other customers. So the beauty is they get good wages, but they also get integrated in the community just like they would if they had an individual job at a company. And then there are the 100-plus people, actually closer to 150 people that have jobs at private sector businesses that we've connected them to. The jobs are varied, a lot of office kind of work, copy clerk, increasingly people helping with scanning and document management. We have a couple people working at law firms doing that kind of work. We have a special training program called Project Search, which helps people through job tryouts and internships, along with some classroom kind of education about the soft skills that you need to get a job. We operate three of those Project Search programs, actually four now, two down at the University of Maryland, one in the hospital and one in the professional schools campus, one at Union Memorial Hospital, and the latest one out at Northwest Hospital. And basically, after that year of job tryouts and classroom training, the people are, for the most part, very job ready. We've had great success placing them. So since they're in a hospital setting, a number of the jobs are hospital-related type jobs. Some people are doing like instrument sterilization in the area where that's done. They do, you know, supply management. They do patient transportation. They work in the hospital cafeterias. So it's really, really a variety. And then outside of the hospital setting, again, people are doing sometimes custodial work, but more often they're doing, you know, assembly or warehouse kind of work. We have a group that works at a place that prepares documents that are getting mailed out to people who have release of lien because they satisfied the payments on their car, and so their title's getting released. And apparently this one particular operation sends out thousands of those documents each week, and it's apparently complicated to fold them, get them in the envelopes just right. And so we have a small group of workers that does that for this particular company. So that's just a sampling of the many kinds of jobs that people can do.
But I'm intrigued by some that you mentioned because they seem to focus on sort of structured and sometimes repetitive, which is exactly what I hear are the jobs that will be vulnerable to being replaced by automation. And so I'm just wondering, looking ahead, if it's going to be harder to find jobs for people with disabilities.
Perhaps to a small extent, but when you look at, you know, the what used to be a file clerk or a copy clerk or whatever, a lot of that is being replaced by scanning and document management that's no longer paper files. Well, the good news is that our folks have been able to learn the skills necessary there. So they may not be filing paper files any longer, but they're scanning documents and helping with an alternative kind of document management. You know, certainly a lot of manufacturing jobs are going away because of automation, but there's plenty of other jobs. I think that the service economy is probably going to continue to offer greater opportunities than a product-based economy, because that's the shift that's happening everywhere. And they haven't automated yet too many of the service things. You know, people, you know, hotels need to have the rooms cleaned, and people need to have their grass cut and their lawns maintained, and on and on and on. So I think that it will continue to look more in the service side of the economy rather than the industrial or product side of the economy. Though I don't think there's opportunities will ever completely go away, which is good news.
We need to take a quick break here. When we're back with Steve Morgan, who has headed the ARC Baltimore since 1985, I'll ask him about the ARC's advice for the Baltimore Police Department. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Stephen Morgan is with me. He's retiring next month after 3 decades leading the ARC Baltimore and nearly 5 decades with the organization that offers a variety of services to people in Baltimore and Baltimore County who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. Last summer, after the U.S. Justice Department issued its tough critique of the Baltimore Police Department, the ARC Baltimore put out a statement. Tell us about relations between the police and the disabled community.
Actually, I think the relationships, at least that we have in Baltimore and Baltimore City, are perhaps even a little better than the report would indicate. We recognized many years ago that the police, regardless of what jurisdiction they were from, and you know whether they were county, state, or local, could easily misunderstand the behavior of a person with a disability who may not have the same social skills as the rest of us and mistake it for noncompliance or a criminal action or whatever. So we've had a relationship with the police departments offering a training component all the way in the academy for new police recruits, acquainting them with the characteristics of people with disabilities and kind of giving them advice for what to look for, and also how to handle a situation they might encounter. So again, so that they don't use what might be more traditional police tactics to deal with the person, which could serve to escalate the situation and make it worse than it needed to be. So by the time the report came out, we had already arranged with the police department to provide that kind of training, not just to new recruits, but to go back and provide the training to really all the police force. And we were getting a lot of cooperation even before the report came out, which now has led to a requirement, really, that training be provided to all police. But it's going to be okay because that had already been arranged and is already underway. So again, and I'm not to say that what was in the report wasn't of concern, because there was that history of misunderstanding and which led in a few cases to mistreatment. But I think we're well on the way to remedying that situation.
It seems like there are so many issues that police need to be trained on. Are you worried that they have the attention to give to this?
Oh, I think so. I think so. It's similar. Obviously, they have to deal with the homeless population, people in the community that may have mental illness. So there are a lot of challenges they have to deal with. But I think that the training is becoming increasingly robust, enabling them to respond to situations in an appropriate manner.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Stephen Morgan, who's retiring next month after 3 decades leading the ARC Baltimore. We've talked about how society has changed a lot of its attitudes toward people with disabilities. Looking ahead, with all the experience that you bring to it, what's the next barrier you think is going to fall for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
My biggest concern looking ahead is, because of the population demographics, the big population segment known as the baby boomers and their offspring, who are only a generation younger, we know because of that those population demographics that the number of people that need more services, more support in getting jobs, but even support later in life when maybe their skills aren't what they used to be, those needs are just going to continue to grow. And we see waiting lists for community services growing. And at the same time—
Let me interrupt to ask, what kinds of when you say community services, give me some examples.
Small group homes, supervised homes where people can live when their families can no longer care for them. Jobs, and if not a job, some kind of a meaningful daytime activity to pursue. And in the case of younger people, supports to families and children who, in addition to getting an education, might also need help in the home. I could give you thousands of examples of that. If we have time, I will. But the good news for all these programs is that over the years, the federal government, through the Medicaid program and a special waiver program under the Medicaid program, has provided support, matching support to the states to enable them to fund these services. And now with the variations and proposals to repeal the Affordable Care Act and replace it with an alternative kind of health care act, what a lot of people don't know is that built into that is a tremendous rollback, cutback in Medicaid funding, and that will redound. A lot of people don't even know that these programs are supported, and this is true all over the country, by federal Medicaid funding. And so there's a real risk there that if they do something radical to change the Affordable Care Act, that the Medicaid program inadvertently will be hurt at the same time. And that will certainly put a stop to any hope for people on waiting lists of getting services in the future, and could even result in current services being scaled back if funds are cut as dramatically as is proposed. Medicaid, I think in most people's minds, all they think about is health care for the poor. And certainly that's a piece of it. And they also may think of long-term nursing care services for the elderly, which is also a component of Medicaid. But what they don't think about is the waiver. It's called a special waiver services that we're able to provide to people with the federal funding. So
we have just a minute left, and I want to make sure I understand what you see might happen with a Medicaid cut in terms of supports that the disabled community relies on?
Again, through that special waiver program, we're talking about services like small group homes, like employment training programs and placement programs and day services and family support services. All of those are supported through the federal Medicaid waiver program. And this is apart from health care services that Medicaid recipients get. But the proposal is just cutting Medicaid funds on the whole and really putting the states in a position to figure out what they're going to do with the lesser funds that they get. So the negative impact, not just on people who currently have health care, possibly losing health care, there's also the risk to this whole different set of services, community-based services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So that's our concern. So it's why we're advocating that any change repeal needs to preserve the Medicaid funding that support these very important services.
I appreciate your flagging that for us. And I'm grateful for this whole conversation. Thank you.
Well, it was good to be here. I appreciate it.
Steve Morgan has been executive director of the ARC Baltimore since 1985. He's retiring next month. At the On the Record page of WIPR.org, we have some information about the ARC Baltimore. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.